From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On this edition of Fresh Air, the economic battle among the U.S., Japan, and Europe. We'll talk with economist Lester Thoreau. He says Japan and Europe don't have unfair advantages in the world market. They're just playing by their own rules, and it's time to update our own. Also, behind the scenes at last night's Academy Awards, we talk with Gil Cates, the producer of the Academy Awards. And we'll also ask Jeff Yarbrough, the senior editor of the gay magazine The Advocate, why the gay activist protest, which was planned to disrupt the ceremonies, never materialized. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. The Supreme Court today made it easier for once-segregated school districts to get out from under court supervision. The High Court's ruling came in a case from Atlanta, and it has the potential for affecting hundreds of other school districts across the country. NPR's Nina Totenberg reports.
The DeKalb County schools in Atlanta, once segregated by law, say they've been striving to desegregate for over 25 years. The schools have operated under court supervision since 1969, and yet more than half the black students attend schools that are 90% black. In 1986, school officials went to court to get out from under court supervision. They asserted that they'd taken all practical steps to desegregate. But a federal court of appeals ruled that because the school system was not fully desegregated in all respects, no part of the system could be released from court supervision. Today, the Supreme Court disagreed, saying that courts may release supervision incrementally. Perhaps even more importantly, the justices said that in this case, since the racial imbalance of the schools was caused by demographic changes and was not traceable to the one-time practices of segregation, school assignment does not have to be manipulated to achieve racial balance. I'm Nina Totenberg at the Supreme Court.
The State Department said today that Iraq is beefing up its military forces in the northern part of the country. Spokesman Richard Boucher said there have been skirmishes with Kurdish rebels in the area, but so far there are no confirmed violations of the Gulf War ceasefire. Under the terms of the ceasefire, Iraq may not fly planes or helicopters in the predominantly Kurdish part of the country, and Iraqi ground forces may not enter a smaller area around three Kurdish towns. Boucher confirmed that Saddam Hussein's forces have shelled Kurdish positions around two key bridges. The German defense minister resigned today after admitting his ministry violated a parliamentary weapons freeze. Deirdre Berger reports from Frankfurt.
Last November, a parliamentary committee decided to put on hold delivery of the last part of a shipment of 150 German army tanks being sent to Turkey. The reason was concern the Turkish government was using these tanks in its battle against Kurdish separatists instead of for the intended NATO defense maneuvers. The Bonn Defense Ministry ignored the parliamentary orders and shipped the tanks as planned. After dismissing a high-ranking defense official yesterday, Defense Minister Gerhard Stoltenberg took personal responsibility and resigned today. Stoltenberg has been under political pressure since last fall when Parliament discovered the Defense Ministry illegally shipped tanks and other weapons to the Israeli intelligence service. For National Public Radio, this is Deidre Berger in Frankfurt.
On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average gained less than a point to close at 3,235. Advances led declines by a slight margin. This is NPR News. A Los Angeles police officer said today that he struck Rodney King with his baton because he was in fear for his life. Lawrence Powell is accused of striking the most blows against the black motorist whose beating was recorded on videotape last year. Powell told jurors that he'd been attacked by King and thought the suspect was under the influence of the hallucinogenic drug PCP. Powell is one of four officers on trial for police brutality. He said that he didn't resort to his baton until he was ordered by his supervisor, Sergeant Stacy Kuhn, to handcuff King and keep him on the ground. The prosecution began its closing arguments today in the drug trafficking and money laundering trial of ousted Panamanian military leader Manuel Noriega. Melissa Mancini has more from Miami.
Assistant U.S. Attorney Miles Malman stood before the court and described Noriega as a man of great power who deceived U.S. drug enforcement officials on a daily basis. The government alleges Noriega abused his power as Panama's de facto leader to help a flood of cocaine pour into the United States. Malman described for the jury Noriega's rise to power and his control over the country. The prosecutor told jurors nothing happened in Panama without Noriega's approval. The government will continue with their closing tomorrow, with the defense following upon the prosecution's completion. For National Public Radio, I'm Melissa Mancini in Miami.
An Indiana appeals court has refused to release Mike Tyson on bail while his lawyers challenged the former heavyweight boxing champion's rape conviction. The three-judge panel issued its decision in a brief statement without comment. It upheld last week's decision by trial judge Patricia Gifford, who denied bond for Tyson on the ground that he might attempt to flee. Tyson's attorneys, including appeals lawyer Alan Dershowitz, argued that there was a good chance that Tyson's conviction would be appealed and little likelihood that he'd attempt to escape. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. America may be the only military superpower, but we face stiff economic competition from Europe and Japan. My guest, Lester Thoreau, says in the post-Cold War era, the main contest has shifted from a military to an economic contest. Unfortunately, he says, Europe and Japan are playing by new business rules, while we're playing by old, outdated ones. Thoreau was once described as the most famous economist in America who has not been the host of a PBS TV series. He's the dean of the MIT Sloan School of Management. Thoreau is probably best known as the author of the bestseller, The Zero-Sum Society. His new book is Head to Head, The Coming Economic Battle Among Japan, Europe, and America. So what's at stake in this confrontation?
Well, what's basically at stake is the high-wage jobs, because everybody in the world wants the high-wage jobs. But the important thing to understand is that this is what I call a competitive, cooperative ball game. It's not just competition, and the other side is not our enemy. They're our rivals, but not our enemies. And I think it's going to be a much, and there are a whole set of things we have to do cooperatively. And so I think it's going to be a much more subtle ball game. There are no evil empires. Nobody gets shot, nobody gets hung, nobody gets taken prisoner. But the fact of the matter is there are people out there in the world who are working very hard to make sure that the industries which are going to generate the high-wage jobs in the 21st century are in their country and not in the United States.
And what industries are those?
Well, the seven key industries that everybody thinks are going to be very important in the 21st century are microelectronics, biotechnology, the new material science industries, telecommunication, civilian aircraft manufacturing, robots plus machine tools, computers plus software. And those would be very high on anybody's set of lists.
Well, you think that Americans really aren't keeping up with the changing rules of the game. For instance, Americans are very self-conscious about how the Japanese have basically cornered the market on video technology. You say that right now those who can make a product cheaper can take it away from the country that actually invented the product. So what does that mean? What implications are in that for where we put our emphasis in industry?
Well, I think they make a tremendous difference, because if the name of the game is invent the new product, for example, if you're looking at education and skills, the education and skills that count are basically the top 20% of the population, because somebody in that group will invent the new product. If the name of the game is being the world's cheapest producer of that product, then in some sense the education and skills that are count that are the bottom 50%. Because people in that group are going to staff the processes, and if they can't do just-in-time inventories, if they can't do statistical quality control, you can't build that product. Inside our corporations, it means instead of allocating your talent to new product development, you have to allocate your talent to your factories. And the route to the top has to change. And so these things have some very profound changes on how we run our corporations and how we run our society.
Well, following this line of thought that the Japanese are making a fortune marketing and producing the products that have been invented in America, what are the research and development implications for that? Are we putting our money in the right place?
Well, I think the answer is no. At the moment, we're putting about two-thirds of our money into new product development and about one-third into process. The Japanese do exactly the opposite, two-thirds into process and one-third into new product. And we need to look a lot more like the Japanese in terms of spending patterns. But we've also got another big R&D problem, and that is that you and I in America have basically run a military R&D system for the last 50 years. About half of all R&D is done by the military. we're going to have to build a civilian R&D system, and we don't know exactly how to do that. And see, that's where benchmarking becomes important. If you're America or an American, you now have to look at the rest of the world and say, what is the best performance standard in the world? Now, you don't have to do it the way they do it, but you have to match that performance standard. And see, there again, Americans for 50 years have basically gotten out of the habit of looking at the rest of the world, because we say, well, who's the best in the world? Why? Obviously, Americans. Now, in many industries, and certainly in consumer electronics is one, Americans are not the best. And therefore, if we want to play in that ballgame, we've got to benchmark vis-a-vis those that are the best and learn how to do it in the United States.
My guest is economist Lester Thoreau, author of the new book, Head to Head, The Coming Economic Battle Among Japan, Europe, and America. You probably also know Lester Thoreau as the author of The Zero-Sum Society. Well, the playing field economically is going to change on January 1st, 1993, when the European community is officially formed. What are some of the advantages they're going to have?
Well, they will become the largest economy in the world. And see, America's been the largest economy in the world for about 120 years. And so if you want to play Major League Economics, you'll go to Europe. And if you want to play AAA ball, you'll be in the United States. Now, the important thing for Americans, however, is that it's always been one of the rights and privileges of the world's largest economy to write the rules for world trade. In the 19th century, the British wrote the rules for world trade. In the 20th century, we Americans wrote the rules for world trade, called the Gatt-Bretton Woods system. In the 21st century, the Europeans will write the rules for world trade. And so we Americans are going to have to learn to play by European rules. Now, if you say, what rules are the Europeans going to write? What I argue is they're going to write the rules for a system which I would call quasi-trading blocks with managed trade. That'll put a tremendous premium on the ability of countries to have governments and corporations work closely together. And the best illustration of the way the Europeans do it, of course, is Airbus Industries. A private company, but owned by the British, French, German, and Spanish governments, designed to crack the American monopoly in aircraft manufacturing, and it's been very successful at doing it. Now, our current response to Airbus Industries is to have a tenter tantrum and yell they're cheating, but the fact of the matter is they're going to write the rules, and Airbus Industries doesn't violate any treaty we, they, or anybody else has ever signed or is going to sign.
Americans have run on the principle that government doesn't participate with private industry in projects, whereas the Europeans and the Japanese believe government should play a role in the economic growth of private industry. So are they officially violating our rules? I mean, could we in America do an Airbus kind of arrangement where the government was playing a part in the creation of this new technology?
Well, they're not violating any rules, but they're not playing the game the way we played it, as you pointed out. They're playing it very differently. Now, if you think about Airbus Industries, it's not to say that we in America should do exactly what the Europeans have done in Airbus Industries, but we have to match them in some dimension. And I think there's no question about it that we're going to have to overcome our history, and governments and industry are going to have to learn to work together in what could be called a growth strategy or a growth policy or something. Because if we don't do that, we will find that we're increasingly squeezed out of high-wage industries.
Okay, when you talk about trading blocks, there's a, on some level that could be like antitrust in our country. And when you talk about government support of industry, well, that could be some kind of socialism in our country, the way it would be interpreted. Yeah.
You're now using a set of words the rest of the world doesn't worry about. The rest of the world isn't worried about antitrust. They don't think that's a very important thing. And we're going to have to change our antitrust laws to play the game the rest of the world plays. The rest of the world, you know, isn't worried about the word socialism one way or another. If you look at the German government, it owns more shares and more companies than probably any non-communist government on the face of the earth. They own Lufthansa, shares in steel companies, shares in Volkswagen. But if you talk to the German who heads Lufthansa, he would tell you he ran a private corporation. And the fact that government owns some of the shares to him is an irrelevant fact. And so they really look at the world quite differently than we do.
The antitrust laws are supposed to be protecting consumers and businesses. How would you like to see them changed?
Well, the simple fact of the matter is most of them are now technologically obsolete. Let me just give you a brief example. Under our antitrust laws, it would be illegal for Ford and General Motors to put up a joint production facility to basically run Toyota out of business. But under our antitrust laws, it's perfectly legal for General Motors and Toyota to have a joint production facility in California, as they do, to run Ford out of business. Now, that's called shooting yourself in the foot. Because our antitrust laws pay no attention to what's going on in the rest of the world. And the fact of the matter is that we can't enforce our antitrust laws in the rest of the world. We're going to have to play a game defined by them, not a game defined by what would Americans like to do.
What kind of government involvement in industry would you like to see? I mean, traditionally in America, the government has given research and development money to industries involved with the military, and that's helped some civilian industries like the aeronautics industry. But what expanded role would you like to see the government play?
Well, one of the places government's going to have to play a role is building this new civilian R&D system, because you're quite right to point out that we've had a military system in the past, and it has had some spinoffs into private industry. But the great thing about a military system is the military knew what it wanted. An airplane that flew at 5,000 miles an hour, a missile that landed within 20 feet, and submarine that stayed underwater forever. If you're talking about civilian R&D, you have to know what you want. All technologies are not created equal. Some lead to big, important industries with lots of high-wage jobs, and others lead to economic dead ends. And so you have to have a bit of an industrial vision out there. Now, that doesn't mean that the government has to pick winners and losers. The way they do it in Europe, in Brussels, is they have a whole set of projects called things like Eureka, Esprit, JESSE, Vision 2500. And these projects all run in a very similar way. The government says, we think this is an important area. We have some money. If you, the private business firms, will get together three firms from at least two different countries and come through the door with 50% of the money, we'll match it if we think it's a good project. And so what it means is that private industry is picking the winners, but the government is then lengthening the time horizon, cutting the costs in half because they match it with half the money, and it allows the corporations to do very different things. But this idea of having a vision as to where you want to go is something that we Americans are going to have to learn how to formulate. Now, that doesn't mean we have to formulate it in a European way or a Japanese way, but it does mean we do have to formulate it in some way that we find consistent with American history, tradition, culture, whatever.
If you're just joining us, my guest is economist Lester Thoreau. You say that the Japanese economic goal is market share maximization. What is that? What do you mean?
Well, I use the phrase producer economics, and I think the easiest way to think about it is think about two farmers. One is running his farm in kind of an Anglo-Saxon American way, and that is he's a cost minimizer, a profit maximizer. He buys a used tractor if that's the most efficient thing to do. He's very careful, but then he earns some money at the end of the day, and at the end of the day, he splurges it on anything he likes. He buys a Mercedes. He takes a Caribbean vacation. He has a big house. We say, spend it any way you like. The other farmer says, I'm not interested in the big Mercedes, I'm not interested in the house, I'm not interested in the Caribbean vacation. What I want is the world's finest tractor, the biggest barn, the grand champion cow. I'm interested in producer goods and services. And I'm going to get to ride that tractor a lot longer than I get to ride my Mercedes. Now, the problem is, suppose those two farmers are competing with each other, which one wins? Well, it's clear which one wins, the guy who's putting his money into the barn, the tractor, the cow. And see, the Japanese have been organized a society that puts a lot more emphasis on producer goods, somewhat less emphasis on consumer goods, and they're going to force us to change. Last year, they invested twice as much as we did in plant and equipment. Doesn't take a genius to know that we can't continue to invest half as much and still have the high-wage jobs of the world. And so this is a perfect example of where some other society in the world, in this case the Japanese, are going to force very profound changes in the American system, or the American system is not going to generate a world-class standard of living. And, you know, you can say, well, that's a hard-nosed choice, but the fact that it matters is it's the real choice.
Japanese companies have been taking over some American companies, Sony, a good example of that. Columbia is the example. Sony took over Columbia.
Columbia Pictures, yeah.
Yeah. What's the significance to America's economic future? With Japan taking over American companies?
Well, it's important to focus on the right things.
Yeah.
The right things is not worrying about Japanese companies buying companies in the United States, because when they do that, they will bring some technology, some management, some investment, and that's a good thing. The thing to worry about is the thing I document in the book, is that the Japanese run a system where basically nobody's been able to run successful companies in Japan. And if you look for companies that are at least 51% owned by foreigners, there, in order to find 132 of them, you have to go all the way down to annual sales of $5 million a year. And some very famous American names in Japan don't have 51% American ownership. Disney Tokyo is not owned by American Disney. McDonald's is not owned by American McDonald's. And the real problem is the rest of the world, not just America, has found it impossible to buy companies in Japan, and that asymmetry is the problem. Nothing to worry about them buying things here, a lot to worry about us being unable to buy things there.
So if they're playing unfair with us by not allowing us to really buy companies there while they buy companies here, what can we do to change that?
Well, the answer is we have to get our house in order. But see, I don't like using the word unfair, because unfair implies that you're violating some set of rules that everybody's agreed on. The Japanese are not violating any set of rules that anybody has ever agreed on. They're not playing the game the American way, but that doesn't mean that they're unfair. And see, I think that's the distinction that has to be made. And so what we, you know, I think there is a real issue on opening up the Japanese economy. It's not an issue between America and Japan. It's an issue between Japan and the rest of the world, because nobody has been successful at cracking into the Japanese economy. The Germans can't do it. The Koreans can't do it. The Italians can't do it. The Americans can't do it. And one of the problems, and it's a Japanese problem that'll have to be solved, is if we want a functioning world economy, Japan has got to be willing to both import more from the rest of the world and allow the rest of the world to acquire assets in Japan.
If you're just joining us, my guest is economist Lester Thoreau. He's the dean of MIT's Sloan School of Management, author of the bestseller Zero Sum Society, and author of the new book, Head to Head. We're going to take a short break, then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Economist Lester Thoreau is my guest. You've come up with a phrase, the American disease, to describe the American obsession with relocating to a place where you could pay really low wages, whether that means locating to a region of America or relocating your plant to a third world country. You think it's a big mistake?
Yeah, it's a big mistake because, see, people talk about the British disease, and by that they mean kind of adversarial labor management relations, lots of work rules, those things. The American disease is this belief that low wages solve all the problems. If you're in trouble as a corporation, just go to some place where wages are lower. The fact of the matter is the only way you can be successful is to go upscale on skills and productivity. Because if the name of the game is low wages, there's always somebody in the world who's paying lower wages. Low wages are easy to copy. High productivity, high skills are hard to copy. And American firms are too prone to bail out as opposed to do the tough job of going upscale in terms of skills, technology, product problems.
Use the textile industry as an example. Well, when a textile company moves to a third world country and they're paying seamstresses very little money to sew things onto dresses or whatever, what's high tech in that? I mean,
well, for example, let's look at the textile industry. The world's largest exporter of textiles is mainland China. No great mystery there. Low wages. But who are the second and third largest exporter of textiles? Well, the answer is Italy and Germany. Mm-hmm. Italy has wages in the textile industry which are as high as American wages, and German wages are way above American wages. The question is, why are they a success and we're a failure? Well, they don't compete with China making men's underwear, but what they've done is defined a fashion industry, a special fabric industry, a quick response industry that can, in fact, compete paying high wages and doing a lot of exporting. A couple of Christmases ago, my secretary gave me a scarf. A scarf is just a rectangular piece of cloth. I looked at the label and I was flabbergasted because it said made in Germany. How can the Germans pay higher wages than Americans, make a rectangular piece of cloth, export it to the United States, and do it successfully? Well, the answer is the label said it was a new fabric called cashmink, which was supposed to have the good characteristics of both cashmere and mink. And they were able to sell that product as something unique in the American market as a premium. And the question is, why didn't Americans do that? And the answer is a certain lack of imagination and this belief the only thing you can do is basically go for low wages if you're in the textile business.
So if you're trying to rebuild the industry with the emphasis on more skilled labor and more innovative ideas, then you've really got to improve the education system.
Absolutely. Both improve it in the K through 12 system and improve it once people graduate from high school. See, this is the only industrial country in the world where there's no post-secondary education system for the non-college bound. The Germans have their apprenticeship system. The Singaporeans do bonding. The French have a 1% of sales tax where every firm has to put 1% of its sales into a fund, which it can only use for training. And if it doesn't train workers with that fund, the government takes the money away. So you're going to do the training because it becomes a free good. And we could do any one of those three or a unique American system. But the fact of the matter is graduating from high school isn't good enough anymore, even if you happen to graduate from a good high school.
You've been very critical of the American economy and American industry during our discussion. What do you think are some of the strengths that America has now?
Well, see, if you take those seven industries that I mentioned and you go through them, you see a lot of American strengths. If you look at microelectronics, that's basically, I think, an even fight between Japan and the United States. There's some places where the Japanese are ahead, like consumer electronics, but there's some places where we're ahead on things like military electronics. If you look at biotechnology, that's an American lead. We've got more PhDs in biotechnology than the rest of the world have combined. If you look at the new material science industries, that ought to be an American strength because we've used a lot of those materials in the military, and the only question now is how do you make them more cheaply and use them in the civilian economy. If you look at telecommunication, I think that's a rather even battle between Japan, Europe, and the United States. If you look at aircraft, that's a battle between Europe and the United States with Japan out of it. If you look at robotics plus machine tools, that's the one place where we're just simply out of it. It's a battle between the Europeans and the Japanese. And then if you look at computers and software, on computers it's a battle between us and the Japanese, but we probably still have a lead, and on computer software we still have a monopoly. So if you think of those critical industries, we have a very good starting position. The problem is, if you did that evaluation in 1980, it would have looked stronger than 1990. The problem is not where we are at the moment, it's the trends, which look very adverse, and the question is, in the 1990s, can we turn those trends around?
So when you look at the competition between the European community, Japan, and the United States economically, who do you think is going to, quote, win?
Well, I argue at the end of the book it's probably will be the Europeans, because the Europeans have strategic position. And I use the analogy with a book on chess endgames where they give you a complicated chessboard and they say black can win in five moves regardless of what white does. Now figure out the five moves. And Europe has exactly that position. They have the strategic position on the chessboard. They may lose, but if they do it right, they can win, and there's nothing that anybody in the United States or Japan can do about it, because Europe is going to get all the economies of scale. There are 800 or 900 million people in Europe, depending on what you think about the Turks in Turkey and in the southern Soviet Union. They're all well-educated. Think about it. You've got Germany, who's a world production export leader, Russia, who's a world science leader, Italy and France, who are world leaders in design, world capital market in London. If you can put the best aspects of all those countries together, you can create a winner that could dominate both Japan and the United States. On the other hand, the Europeans may not be able to bring it off, and they may throw it away.
Lester Thoreau, you were one of Paul Tsongas's economic advisors. How did you feel about his suspension of his campaign?
Well, I think, you know, the basic problem we're talking about here is we're at this transition point when Americans are kind of have a lot of free-floating anxiety, fear, hostility, all those kind of things, and they feel a little bit cheated. And they need somebody who can point out to them what is the direction for solving these problems in the next decade. And to do that, you both have to know where you want to go and have to be one of the world's great salesmen. And I guess the thing you'd have to say about the Tsongas campaign is, in some sense, he proved he was not one of the world's great salesmen since he had to drop out. But the idea that we have to have a growth policy, which is one of the ideas he was selling, I think sooner or later we're going to come to that realization. And if we come to it sooner, we're going to be much better off than if we come to it later.
Lester Thoreau, thank you very much for talking with us.
You're welcome.
And Lester Thoreau is the author of the new book, Head to Head, The Coming Economic Battle Among Japan, Europe, and America. He's also the dean of MIT's Sloan School of Management. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio. ¶¶
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, behind the scenes at last night's Academy Awards, we talk with the award's producer, Gil Cates, about how he prepares for the unexpected or the expected. And we'll ask Jeff Yarbrough of the gay magazine The Advocate why gay rights activists didn't demonstrate within the Dorothy Chandler Pavilion as they had planned. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. In New York City, the UN Security Council has approved a resolution imposing an air and arms embargo on Libya. The measure also bans arms sales to the country. NPR's Jim Zaroli reports.
The resolution says airplanes may no longer fly into or out of Libya. It also calls on countries to expel most Libyan diplomats and ban arms sales to the country. The resolution was approved by a vote of 10-0 with China and the non-aligned countries of Morocco, Zimbabwe, Cape Verde, and India abstaining. They complained that the Security Council should have tried to resolve the dispute with Libya before resorting to sanctions. The resolution is aimed at pressuring Libya to cooperate with the investigations into two airplane bombings, including the downing of Pan Am Flight 103 over Lockerbie, Scotland in 1988. U.S. Ambassador Thomas Pickering called the resolution a multilateral, nonviolent response to violent and brutal acts. Under the resolution, the embargo doesn't take effect until April 15th, giving Libya more time to comply with the terms and avert sanctions. In New York, this is Jim Zaroli reporting.
Montana will lose one of two congressional seats under a U.S. Supreme Court ruling announced today. Montana had challenged the formula that Congress uses to allocate House seats among the states. NPR's Howard Berkus reports.
The complex mathematical formula redistributes a constant number of House members among the 50 states based on population shifts. Montana actually gained population in the 1980s, but essentially lost one of its two House seats to a state that grew even more. State officials aren't surprised by the ruling. In fact, Montana's two sitting congressmen announced long ago that they would each seek the state's lone congressional seat. Eastern Montana Republican Ron Marlaney and Western Montana Democrat Pat Williams have been campaigning hard for months. The two incumbents are popular, ideological opposites who were first elected in the late 70s. Montana's depleted congressional delegation may ask Congress to change the formula and restore the lost seat. This is Howard Berkus reporting.
And in a ruling that could affect hundreds of school districts around the country, the U.S. Supreme Court has ended federal court supervision over student enrollment in DeKalb County, Georgia. This ruling overturned a lower court decision that found a school system achieves full integration if it has racial equality for 3 years in six categories. Federal judges have used these categories routinely since a 1968 Supreme Court decision. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved up less than a point to close at 3,235.47 on volume of 182 million shares. This is NPR News. Voters in Vermont are taking part in Democratic caucuses this evening, while Bill Clinton and Jerry Brown are taking part in debates in New York in advance of next week's primary. In a debate today on urban policy, Clinton said that Brown's 13% flat tax plan would be very, very damaging to many cities. Brown argued that the current tax system is a ball and chain on the U.S. economy. New York Governor Mario Cuomo has canceled plans to go to California to address a state Democratic convention because he says the trip has raised speculation that he might still get into the presidential race. He also warned that Democrats should stop trying to find an alternative to Clinton and Brown because he says this process would chew them up as fast as they appear. Republican presidential challenger Pat Buchanan campaigned in Milwaukee today. He says Wisconsin's open primary could give him a large protest vote April 7th. Ann Hensel of member station WUWM reports.
Wisconsin residents can split their vote and select candidates from any party for each race on the ballot. Pat Buchanan says he could win the state since voters could pick local representatives and still send a protest message to the White House. Both potential candidate H. Ross Perot and former California Governor Jerry Brown have attracted protest attention, but Buchanan says he still has an audience.
Jerry Brown comes from another ring, if you will, of American politics. He's a protest candidate of the left. I am not of the left. Nobody's accused me of that recently.
Buchanan says he'll continue his campaign for change, regardless of the results in Wisconsin next Tuesday. For National Public Radio, I'm Ann Hensel in Milwaukee.
The Commerce Department says its index of leading economic indicators has moved up 0.8%. This is National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I was up way past my bedtime last night watching the Academy Awards. I stuck it through to the end, not only to find out who got the Oscars for Best Picture and Best Director. I wanted to see if the protests we'd all heard so much about would materialize. Well, they didn't, and in a few minutes we'll talk about why they didn't with Jeff Yarbrough of the gay magazine The Advocate. The producer of the Academy Awards has to be prepared for just about anything, from political protests to long acceptance speeches, and in last night's case, one-handed push-ups. We called producer Gil Cates to talk about the action behind the scenes last night. This was his third year as the producer of the Academy Awards. He's also the dean of the School of Theater, Film, and Television at UCLA and the past president of the Directors Guild. Cates was prepared for disruptions by gay activists protesting homophobia in Hollywood. Although there were demonstrations and arrests outside the pavilion, there were no demonstrations inside. But even if there were, Cates would have tried to keep them off camera.
If you have a dinner party in your home and someone comes to your dinner party and wants to behave in a manner that you don't think is appropriate for your invitation, you'd ask that person to leave. Similarly, this is a celebration of excellence in filmmaking. People are on stage to present awards to their colleagues, and if someone comes and attempts to disrupt that, it seems to me perfectly reasonable to assume that you'd simply ask the person to leave and carry on with the show. That's the long and the short of it.
So what kind of plans did you put into effect to try to stop the disruptions?
Well, you know, there are really not too many plans you can put into effect. I'm a big believer in the First Amendment, and I think as far as demonstrating outside the pavilion, they're entitled to demonstrate, and they should have their area to demonstrate and call attention to what they want to call their attention to. I think that's what happens in a democracy. And that's fine. My principal concern was interrupting the show, and my real feeling about it, Terry, was that it didn't seem to me an appropriate show to be interrupted, because the gay and lesbian community has worked in great number in the Hollywood community, and the Academy Award show, particularly this year, everyone was wearing the AIDS red ribbon to signify their support for eradicating, you know, that awful disease. And it just did not seem to me to be an appropriate place for them. And I think either cooler heads prevailed and they didn't get into the theater, or maybe the security we had was adequate to keep them out. Because the security at the Academy Awards is always pretty thoughtful, in the sense that it's very difficult to get tickets and all the tickets are numbered, and it would just be hard for someone to get a ticket who didn't belong in the theater.
What kind of extra security did you add for last night?
We really didn't add any extra security. We had the regular security that we always have in the theater. As a matter of fact, I think we had less security in a way than we did the year before, which is when we were concerned about a terrorist attack potentially because of the war in Iraq. You know, we were concerned about bomb scares, and we had police dogs sniffing out for explosives. I mean, the security is adequate inside. We just want to make sure that only people who belong in the theater get in the theater. There are a lot of big stars there, and as you know, they sometimes attract people who are not the kind of people you want to have around, so that the security is about the same as it's been, holding aside last year, properly as it's been the last 10 years.
So what is that like exactly? How many guards are there in the Dorothy Chandler Pavilion?
Well, for obvious reasons, we don't talk about that. It's really no one's business. It wouldn't be secure if we told you how many security people we had. It is not an overwhelming amount. I mean, it's just what you'd think would be reasonable and fair.
Mm-hmm. Did you give the presenters any advice about what to do if there was a disturbance in the pavilion?
I told one or two presenters that if there was a disturbance that they should just carry on, that the odds of hearing a demonstrator was very limited because the microphones are very, very directional. And if someone even shouts very loud, as little as 50 or 60 feet away, would be very hard to hear it at home. So I simply told one or two people that if that should happen, they should just continue with their job.
And what would you have done with the cameras?
We just would have kept going on with the show.
Mm-hmm. If you're just joining us, my guest is Gil Cates, the producer of the Academy Awards. So what was your biggest surprise last night?
Well, my biggest surprise was my first surprise, and that was when the when Jack Palance got his award and jumped down and did some push-ups and really did one heck of an acceptance speech that took 3 or 4 minutes. That was my first surprise.
Do you send out some kind of advisory to all the nominees,
yes,
begging them to be brief?
Yes.
How does it read? What do you tell them?
Oh, it's a very nice letter. I congratulate them. I don't really remember the text of it, but essentially I asked them to remember that it's a television show and we want everyone to have their moment in the sun, but please try to keep it under 45 seconds or so. And then there's a nominees luncheon, which takes place a couple of weeks before the show, and I mention at the nominees luncheon the same thing. I usually say something like, there are over a billion people in 115 countries watching, and if you come out there and thank, your mom and dad, you're going to make your mom and dad very happy, but you may send 999,000,000,999, out of the room. Actually, I do like when they are very personal. I do like when they thank their mothers and fathers. My personal feeling is that anything that shows a nominee who gets the award in that light is very, very interesting. What's a little bit tough to take are long laundry lists of professionals that are mentioned which have no meaning to anyone except those people on the list. And still in all, that's okay if you do it in a reasonable period of time. Do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Someone wants to get up there and spend 45 seconds thanking, 25 people. I don't particularly find that interesting or helpful to the show, but that's their right because they got the award. It's when they want to take a minute or 2 minutes doing that it really becomes, I think, rude.
Did you know last night that Howard Ashman's lover was going to accept the award on his behalf, or was that a surprise?
Nope, I knew that. As a matter of fact, I spoke with him earlier in the day and told him it was all right if he did that. The Academy has a position that if someone doesn't come because they're shooting or they can't be there, like if Robert De Niro couldn't come, or occasionally someone doesn't turn up because they're ill, then the position of the Academy is that for the presenter to say that the Academy accepts the award on behalf of. When someone passes away, as was the case in the award you're referring to, obviously, that person couldn't help but not be there, and we think it's appropriate to have someone accept the award for them either.
Right. What was your reaction last night when, I'm forgetting her name, but when one of the winners talked about boycotting GE?
Oh, the winner of the documentary winner, of the Documentary Short Award. Well, what was my reaction to it? My reaction to it was, she's entitled to do that, I guess.
So it doesn't bother you that somebody's bringing their politics into the acceptance
speech?
Well,
you know something, that's a very good question, and it doesn't bother me in that particular case because that was what her documentary was about, and that's the reason she won that award. Now, that particular documentary was about GE, and she won the award because of what she had done in that documentary, so that it really had to do with her art, her craft, and her work, which has nothing to do with my politics one way or the other. What I object to is when an actor or actress or other category winner gets up there and wins a specific award for their work and changes the moment from their work and their award to something that has nothing to do with it, which was not the case with the documentary winner yesterday.
Mm-hmm. Let me ask you, when you accepted your Emmy Award for something that you had produced, what did you say in the 45 seconds you were allotted?
What I did, that's a great question. I was very careful. I knew a lot of my colleagues were going to be watching and seeing if I practiced what I preached. Firstly, I wrote what I was going to say, and I timed it so that it was clearly within 45 seconds. I thanked those people on the show for their contributions to it. That's what I did.
Gil Cates produced last night's Academy Awards. This is Fresh Air. Over 10 gay demonstrators were arrested outside the Dorothy Chandler Pavilion last night, protesting against homophobia in Hollywood. The militant gay group Queer Nation had planned on disrupting the ceremonies inside, but they didn't. Jeff Yarbrough is the senior editor of the gay magazine The Advocate. We asked him why nothing happened.
I think there were two problems. One is, of course, security. Despite what the Academy said, security was beefed up to a level that I've never seen it, and I've attended four or five Academy Awards. There were ushers literally every 3 to 4 feet lining the pavilion inside just waiting for something to happen. The security outside and at the entrance to the event was also incredibly heavy, and apparently, from what I've heard, 100% of the attempts to cause action inside the awards were foiled by security. People were taken away, not allowed in. Banners were taken from certain people who had tickets and were going to sit and, I guess, raise signs at one point during the ceremony. And the other thing is, I think basically Queer Nation decided that the action had been such an overwhelming success without actually doing the action that they decided just to not risk it.
Were you there last night?
Yeah, I was down there at the protest.
So you were inside or outside?
I was outside. Then I went back up to two of the parties here in West Hollywood and watched from there.
Mm-hmm. So what have you found out about what the plans were? What was supposed to happen if everything came off?
Queer Nation at one point, was interested in distributing these sort of maps of the gay stars' homes, which sort of became quite a media event. If I had one more a straight media outlet calling me here at The Advocate asking me for a copy of that map, they sort of decided not to do that sort of thing because they felt that it was causing too much media furor and causing the media to miss the point. They also quashed the idea of holding up signs when suspected closeted gays who were either up for nominations or attending the awards would pass by. They also decided not to do that because they just felt that they would be looked at in sort of a sinister way by the media, so they dropped that angle at the last minute. In terms of inside action, the outside action was their typical noisy Queer Nation sort of obnoxious protest, which certainly has its place in the gay civil rights movement. But inside, it looks like either they were foiled completely or they just decided to give it up at the last minute and not risk the arrests.
So what did you think of the Academy Award ceremonies last night?
Well, I think it was an amazing night for a couple of reasons. One, to have one lesbian and one openly gay person on the podium accepting awards last night was quite something to watch. Deborah Chasnoff, who is an openly lesbian documentary producer who won the Academy Award for her short film Deadly Deception, talked about her life partner and her adopted son, and at the same time, called for a boycott of General Electric. So it was quite a political statement all rolled into one 45-second little speech. To see Bill Lash accepting for Howard Ashman was quite something because, just like Deborah, he talked about his relationship with Howard. He talked about the fact that Howard was the first nominee and winner who died of AIDS. And that showed that awareness is peaking in terms of AIDS and in terms of homosexuality and lesbianism, you know, in Hollywood. We also had that sort of obnoxious red ribbon campaign, which I think has run its course. Enough with the red ribbons. We need to do something else. I think basically those ribbons, which are supposed to make people feel that the community is aware of people suffering with AIDS, is basically a tiny little Band-Aid on the real problem. People need to start speaking out on that problem, like Richard Gere did from the podium last night, rather than just wearing a ribbon on their $45,000 couture gown.
Jeff, one last question. How does the Advocate plan on covering the Academy Awards and the protests around them?
In terms of the actual protests themselves, we will do a news story, and we will be following closely what happened in terms of arrests last night, and if the arrests were indeed warranted. Those are the kind of things the Advocate and our lawyers will be following closely.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Sure, thank you.
Jeff Yarbrough is the senior editor of The Advocate. This is Fresh Air. Noah Adams is with us. Noah, what's coming up on All Things Considered?
Hi, Terry. A Supreme Court ruling today on desegregation. The court is saying that integration may be achieved incrementally, and that could affect hundreds of school districts around the country. NPR's John Burnett reports from Mexico on efforts to open up communal farming to more public use there. Phyllis Crockett brings us an update on the presidential campaign of H. Ross Perot, the Texas billionaire who would love to be drafted to run for the White House. The United Nations is pondering sanctions against Libya, and now lots of countries are complaining that Libya does not want to let foreign nationals leave their country.
Thanks, Noah. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. If you believe his press, you might think Garth Brooks is country music nowadays. Rock critic Ken Tucker says there's life beyond Brooks, but first a song from the superstar.
Well, I'm shameless when it comes to loving you. I'll do anything you want me to. I'll do anything at all. And I'm standing. Ever all the world is she. Oh, baby, that's what's left of me. Don't have very far fall. You know now I'm not a man who's ever been insecure about the world I've been living in. I don't break easy, I have my pride. But if you need to be satisfied, I'm shameless.
As someone who has become over the past few years intensely interested in country music, I would like to say that I am heartily sick of Garth Brooks, who has carried country to the top of the pop charts, but who now threatens to become as overhyped as Michael Jackson. It's not really Brooks's fault that his singles have been played too often and his face reproduced everywhere. Newspapers, magazines, and TV shows have turned Brooks into the symbol of the country renaissance, whereas the phenomenon is much more broadly based. There is, for example, Wynonna Judd, who will release her first solo album at the end of this month. Wynonna used to be one half of the Judds, along with her mother, Naomi. The Judds made rather ordinary pop country, but Wynonna has an exceptionally strong emotional voice. And for her first single, she's taken a maudlin, awkwardly titled song called She Is His Only Need and turned it into something quite special, a lovely folk-influenced ballad.
That's when he started going over the line. Working overtime to give her things just to hear her say she don't deserve them. But he loved her and he just kept going overboard. Over the limit to afford to give her things he knew she wanted. Cause without her, she is his only need.
The Wynonna Judd album will be, I'm betting, a big hit. That single already is. But another notable country release is already doomed to obscurity, lost in the Garth Brooks hype. It's the debut album by Jim Lauderdale called Planet of Love.
I wasn't fooling around. Everything's true that I said. So take me seriously, darling, please just take me. I wasn't fooling around.
Planet of Love came out a couple of months ago. It was produced by Rodney Crowell to achieve a clean, unadorned style. Lauderdale likes to mix bluesy riffs and tight swinging rhythms into his music. He sings with a reedy ache in his voice, and I can't imagine why more people haven't been drawn into his moody, affably neurotic tales of heartbreak and regret. Maybe after Garth Mania dies down, Lauderdale will receive his due. In the meantime, you heard him here first.
I found a new planet that only I can see. Just came back to get you. Let's leave this misery.
Lauderdale's album is Planet of Love. Ken Tucker writes about popular culture for Entertainment Weekly. If you have any questions or comments about Fresh Air, call our toll-free listener line at 1-800-NPR-WHYY. That's 1-800-NPR-WHYY. I'm Terry Gross.
I got tired of losing, but now
major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
When toilet paper and tampons become luxury items, the trivial becomes political. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Croatian journalist Slovenka Drakulic about her new collection of essays, How We Survived Communism and Even Laughed. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.